Welcome to the IGIS Institute Sounds of Safety podcast, where our community will be delving into a series of critical issues supporting the public sector mission space. In this episode, we bring you another robust conversation about offender and jail management systems to help explain the tools at the very heart of modernizing agency operations. Joining us again are four seasoned leaders from the IGIS Corrections Advisory Committee: Rick Davis, Lynn Ayala, Jerry Brenniger, and Krista Murray. Together, they'll unpack the real challenges agencies face with the overall implementation process that includes the balancing of agency priorities, the navigation of competing interests, and how to make sure you have the right team in place to drive success.
Welcome back to the IGIS Institute Offender Management System Implementation Podcast, the show where we dive deep into the unique challenges and opportunities of corrections technology. I'm your host, Rick Davis, and on behalf of our esteemed panel of Krista Murray, Lynn Ayala, Jerry Brenniger, we are glad you are here for episode number 4. Now, today we're diving into implementation, planning, and organization change management, the real make or break phase of any offender management system rollout. Now, we're going to look at how agency priorities shape your approach, why executive sponsorship matters, and how to set clear expectations for scope, timelines, and outcomes. We're also going to talk a little bit about staffing, choosing the right people for the project, and some practical ways to handle change management across both business and IT teams. And of course, we're going to talk about working with your vendor, building long-term relationships, managing contracts, and keeping both sides aligned from start to finish. You know, we've got a lot to discuss on this podcast today, team, so let's go ahead and get started. So when you're planning a new offender management system, there are always competing interests across the corrections agency. You have prison operations, you have community corrections, administration, IT, leadership, and all the end users. Everyone has different needs. Now, getting everyone aligned early can make or break a project of this magnitude. So welcome back to the podcast, Lynn, and I'm going to throw this complex question out to you to begin with. Why should a corrections agency define and communicate its top priorities to all the stakeholders before an OMS implementation begins?
Thanks, Rick, and good morning, everyone. It's great to be with you again. As you said, we have a lot of important topics to cover this morning, so I'm just going to dive right in. And again, as you mentioned, there's always competing priorities, and even after those priorities have been established, executive leadership has to be responsive to external forces and sometimes internal realities that might require a shift in priorities at any given moment. So state strategic plans usually dictate what those priorities are to a certain extent, and legislatures usually fund those IT initiatives based on how well they're aligned with state level priorities. But there's still a lot of discretion available in terms of which initiatives to implement and in what order. And in many cases, the modernization of an OMS has made its way to the top of the priority list in some states. As we discussed in our last podcast, an OMS encompasses a broad spectrum of functionality, and it may not be possible to replace an entire OMS in one implementation. For example, funding may only be available for a portion of the system, and from a people perspective, there may be a limit as to how much change can be absorbed by the organization at any one time. The goal, of course, is to have the largest positive impact on the agency's ability to achieve its mission as efficiently and effectively as possible. I know that sounds like a cliche, but it is the bottom line. So how do we go about determining what our top priorities are when it comes to implementing an OMS, and why is it important to do that before you get started? First of all, and I believe we've discussed this in prior podcasts, we have to assess the risks and the needs of the organization so we can determine which business process areas present the greatest risk if problems aren't going to be addressed. In other words, what happens if we don't do anything? And which improvements can provide the greatest return on investment in the shortest amount of time? All of this needs to be done, of course, within the framework of the agency's mission and goals, which of course focuses on the safety of inmates, public safety, staff safety, reducing recidivism rates, providing treatment and rehabilitation needs for the offenders. And in the case of Texas, we also provide assistance to crime victims. So in thinking about what those top priorities should be, I recommend that the following items be taken into consideration. We need to consider the stakeholders, both internal and external stakeholders, and what their level of influence on the outcomes will be, and which business processes directly impact public safety and the safety of other offenders and staff. Which business areas are experiencing the greatest challenges in terms of their pain points? And as far as staffing, maybe they have persistent staffing shortages, long processing times. How long does it take to complete the process from start to finish? Is it primarily a paper-driven process? And a lot of processes are data dependent, but they lack current or accurate data, and it results in the need for lots of rework, or it causes increased risk in terms of errors when we're making decisions about how to manage offenders. How many offenders are involved or impacted by those business processes, and how many staff are involved? For example, some processes affect all inmates, sentencing and time calculation, intake and classification, housing, just to name a few. But not all inmates are involved in the disciplinary process or file a grievance. So taking those types of factors into consideration when you're prioritizing where to start, I think is very important. The interdependencies between process areas and functions from an organizational perspective, meaning from the people and the process perspective, and from the back-end perspective as well. Who owns the data, who creates the data, and who uses that data? The goal is to become more efficient, to improve processing times with fewer resources where possible, and to become more effective, to improve our outcomes. This is really critical because there will be a perception that there are winners and losers when decisions are made about which processes get prioritized or get implemented first. So understanding what the impact of that is and being able to communicate that across the organization and communicate why and how everyone benefits. If one area is improved, we all benefit from that, and being able to communicate that and when establishing those priorities is very, very important.
Thank you so much, Lynn. You know, that why and how is without a doubt the most critical, right? Hey, so welcome back to the podcast, Krista. Let me ask you, correction agencies, you know, are complex. Why is the alignment across leadership and departments so essential for a project of this magnitude?
Thanks, Rick. While I haven't personally gone through the process of implementing an offender management system, from what I've learned in implementing other systems, alignment across leadership and departments is absolutely essential. Without that alignment, things can get messy real fast. When everyone's on the same page, leadership, operations, in our case, probation, facilities, it creates a shared vision of what the system is supposed to do. It's not just about installing new software. It's about improving how people communicate, how data is managed, and how decisions are made. If each department is using its own approach or defining things differently, that consistency falls apart and the system can't function the way it's meant to. So alignment also helps with buy-in. Rolling out a new system changes how people work, and that can be uncomfortable for many. When leadership speaks with one voice and supports the same goals, it builds trust and helps staff understand the bigger picture. It's a lot easier to adjust to change when you feel included and informed instead of blindsided. And finally, a strong alignment helps with resources and sustainability. And I think Lynn kind of went into some of this. When everyone's coordinating on budget, staffing, and priorities, it keeps the implementation organized and set up for long-term success. So even though I haven't been through it myself, it's clear that, you know, without that alignment, you're layering technology on top of existing silos, and that will defeat the purpose of integrating an offender management system. It also opens up staff to create their own tracking or their own systems if you don't receive that buy-in.
Krista, terrific answer, and you're absolutely right. Folks will tell you all throughout corrections, there's silo systems all over the place just for the reasons that you discussed. So thank you so much. So, you know, leadership is absolutely critical for implementing one of these offender management systems. So let's talk about the role of an executive sponsor or sponsors in a project like this. So Lynn, tell us, what role do executive sponsors play in keeping a project like this on track and mission focused?
Yes, Rick, and you mentioned this earlier, and I'm going to say it again, I think it bears repeating. Once decisions are made as to what those top priorities are, the executive sponsor has to understand and communicate the why. In this case, I think the why may even be more important than the what. Communication is going to be key, and consistent messaging is essential. It's the executive sponsor that provides the resources, that provides the leadership that's needed to achieve long-term success. I think of an example to me is in the world of college football. If a team is winning, you know, the head coach is awesome and the players are wonderful. If the team's losing, however, it's the head coach's fault. You know, in this case, I'd say people are going to blame the executive sponsor. It's due to a lack of leadership, a lack of commitment, a lack of knowledge and experience. Maybe they had a faulty game strategy or poor communication skills, an inability to motivate the team. They've got the wrong players, et cetera, et cetera. So on an OMS implementation, it's the opposite of those things, right? We need the head coach to provide leadership, to demonstrate commitment, to demonstrate that they have knowledge and experience in terms of corrections and what's actually happening on the ground. The strategy is fully supported by leadership at the top level and through mid-level management. They have great communication skills and they have the ability to motivate the team. And I put together some bullets to me that kind of say it all. Don't say one thing in public and say another thing behind closed doors. You have to be consistent in your messaging and make sure that that message is making its way to the rank and file, not just to the top level, but that that message is being communicated throughout the organization. And it's really important to build and keep a strong relationship with the IT team, particularly the project manager. And don't be, you know, taking sides. You have to be open-minded and focus on finding out how to fix a problem in case problems do arise, which we know they will. Be prepared to provide the right resources for the team and be prepared to make some hard decisions along the way. People are going to look to you as the executive sponsor to set the tone. And if you believe and you demonstrate and you communicate that you think it's going to be successful, the staff are going to follow you. You have to be a good leader. Don't avoid bad news. I've worked for some folks who have made it pretty clear that if something's going wrong, they don't want to know about it. They only want to hear the good news. But a good leader, and I may be going into the next question here, and I apologize if I am, a good executive sponsor makes it known that they want to hear what's going on, not just good news. And be responsive to the team's needs, but don't give knee-jerk reactions if something does go wrong or if there is a challenge that needs to be addressed. And acknowledge accomplishments, give praise when it's due, and give it publicly, both verbally and in writing. It's so important to keep everybody on track and keep everybody focused on what the mission is and what the goals are of the project. And they're going to look to the executive sponsor to see how well that person is actually supporting the project and believes in the mission and what is going to be accomplished.
Lynn, you did such an awesome job of explaining why executive sponsorship will often make or break a project like this, major implementation effort. So, you know, having that kind of leadership in a corrections organization that is visible on a project like this, that is engaged, that is, as Crystal was talking about, aligned with those agency priorities will absolutely set the tone for a project like this. And I have to share with you all today is that I worked at the Virginia Department of Corrections with an absolute outstanding executive sponsor. And her name was Deputy Director of Over Administration, Cookie Scott. She was with our agency for over 40 years. And when she was named executive sponsor, one of the things that so incredibly impressed me about her in this particular role is that she never, ever wavered in her support of the system. You know, we absolutely made an outstanding team with her being on it. You know, she worked hard to ensure that we had all the necessary resources, the funding for the project. And when we faced criticism, she would calmly explain the criticality of one of these offender management systems and why everyone needed to be on board with the project. I tell you, she had a talent that is really underappreciated these days in that she very much listened intently to the stakeholders And when necessary, she helped to address their concerns. And I have to tell you, I really learned a lot from that approach and that style, and it made me a better communicator for the projects. So with that, Jerry, what have we missed in the role of the executive sponsor? And welcome back to the podcast. I should have said that to begin with. So welcome, Jerry.
Thanks. Good morning, all. It's so good to be back for another interesting conversation. Rick, both you and Lynn talked a lot about the quality so far. Completely agree with all of that. You know, the individual has to be passionate about the effort, supportive, as you said, has to have an ability to understand the IT as well as the business perspective, I think, and be willing to step in whenever needed. Rick, in your example, and I completely see how your deputy director was effective. And I think that the person in this role has to be someone high enough in your organization that can make those command decisions when necessary and help resolve those things that can seem insurmountable at times. All of that is important. But I think it's also important to note another leadership role here, and that's of the IT owner. So this could be your CIO, or it may be someone else within your IT that's handling that role. But this individual is the one ultimately accountable for the entire life cycle of the system, the OMS itself, you know, starting from procurement through development, implementation and integration, subsequent modification and support thereafter. It can be a very, very busy role, but it's somewhat different than the sponsor, but equally important, I think. So the IT owner role needs to have the ability to think and shift between strategic and tactical very quickly and often. So it requires a nimble flexibility. And if this role is effective, I think much of what bubbles up from, you know, the project team and the PM, you know, at this intermediary level can be addressed with just regular updates to the sponsor to keep only those highest level type items from going up to the sponsor.
Thank you, Jerry. Yeah, you know, I'm partial to the information technology aspect of this, and you raise a really good point. Let's talk about a difficult topic as part of this podcast today, managing expectations of a project of this size. You know, even with the best implementation plans, you know, we're going to run into challenges. There's shifting priorities of the agencies. You'll often get into resource constraint, or there could even be some unexpected technical hurdles encountered in it. So setting realistic expectations from the start can absolutely go a long way toward keeping everyone aligned and engaged throughout the entire process. So, Krista, I'm going to throw this first very difficult subject to you. How does a correction agency set and manage realistic expectations for project timelines, outcomes, and dealing with challenges along the way?
Well, managing expectations is definitely a big part of implementing any system. So as I mentioned before, you know, alignment across leadership and departments really lays the foundation for any big system implementation. Once that's in place, the next big piece is setting and managing realistic expectations for the project timelines, outcomes, and challenges. The most successful agencies do this through early planning and, frankly, honest communication. They start by clearly defining the project scope, such as what's included and what's not, and what success actually looks like. That clarity keeps everyone grounded and helps prevent scope creep later on. And then they break the project into phases or milestones instead of trying to launch everything at once. Each phase has its own deliverables and viewpoints, which makes it easier to track progress and adjust timelines as needed. It's also a way to celebrate small wins along the way, which helps maintain momentum. Another key step is involving end users early. By getting feedback from staff who will actually use the system, agencies can identify pain points, training needs, or policy conflicts before they become major obstacles. Part of managing realistic expectations is keeping the project on task and tied to the contract. It's easy for new ideas or nice-to-haves to creep in, but staying focused on the agreed-upon requirements ensures the team meets deadlines, controls costs, and delivers what is promised. Leadership plays a big role in reinforcing that discipline, reminding everyone that enhancements can come later, but the core system has to come first. That combination of structure, transparency, and focus keeps the project moving forward and helps everyone stay confident in the process, even when challenges arise.
Thank you, Krista, very much. So, Jerry, what are some of the best practices for keeping stakeholders informed and engaged in a project of this magnitude?
Sure, Rick. And if you don't mind, I'll just add a couple of more comments on the previous question. So, Krista is absolutely correct. I mean, the best way to manage expectations is continual communication. You need to make sure you have that ongoing awareness. You should keep abreast of discussions that you're having that includes IT and your end user community and the vendor that may require system customization. Krista mentioned this also to make sure that both stakeholders and leadership understand the time implications of continuing to make changes to the system. You know, what can be done now versus later as an enhancement, you know, to kind of keep on top of shifting scope or scope creep. Of course, requirements and needs change, and many of these change requests are valid, but they do need to be vetted to make that informed decision whether or not they're necessary. And of course, then they have to be scoped. The cost needs to be determined and agreed to. Thereafter, they have to be slated for development, release, testing, and so forth. Every one of these change requests can have an impact on your project timeline. So ensuring that they are required is key. And if they are, the team and leadership needs to be informed so that they understand the impact. Of course, from a technical perspective, managing the project timeline via Gantt or some other method needs to happen. But I also think it's important to keep up with change requests and bugs and so forth via tools such as DevOps, CollabNet, or some similar as well, so that you can track comments, approvals. You can help set priority based on criticality, as we've mentioned, and also understand when and what release or patches those items will be delivered. And of course, it goes without saying that, you know, as managing a project, you know, add reserve for everything because items rarely go exactly according to plan. So back to your question, Rick, sorry about that. So best practices. Engagement early, often, from the beginning. Krista mentioned this. IT needs to understand the business process and needs before the system's purchased. Vendor needs to understand to ensure the needs can be met with their product. So involving stakeholders in planning and decision-making throughout the effort helps ensure those needs are met and concerns are addressed. Involve your SMEs in your meetings. From the beginning, in discovery sessions, through gap analysis, solution documentation, sprint reviews, and actively encourage them to share their thoughts and concerns. It's an important opportunity for stakeholders to understand the challenges on the vendor side. So providing them with documentation from these activities and asking them to weigh in and also require them to approve these can be a really important thing to do. Including them in the testing from the business process perspective is important. And I think including your end users and SMEs throughout these activities helps let them know that their concerns and needs are both understood and valued.
Thank you, Jerry. Yep, it's always about communication, isn't it? Let's turn our attention to project staffing. Now, I have to tell you, I was absolutely blessed with an incredible team of corrections professionals at the Virginia Department of Corrections who worked on our OMS implementation, many of which those individuals are still working there today. Now, I have to tell you that our project would have never, ever been implemented without their hard work and their dedication. I know that they're listening to this podcast, so I can never say thank you enough to them. So going back to you again, Jerry, I have to ask you, who are the best folks at the correction agency to be assigned to an implementation team for a system replacement, like an offender management modernization?
Sure. And, you know, I think we touched on this in a prior episode. And the discussion was that the best people to have on the team are those that are hardest to do without in the operational areas. I do still agree with this, But Krista also brought up a point in that same episode that centered around the younger generation and talking about them having difficulty accepting antiquated systems and manual paper processes. You know, they don't want to be writing status information on whiteboards and carrying around clipboards. So I've been thinking about that comment in conversation, and I think including those individuals that may be closer to the start of their corrections career could be an important consideration as well. You know, bringing the younger generation in, those individuals who are perhaps more acclimated to constant technological change and may be more receptive to it because it's really all they've ever known. It also could help balance the group and provide different perspectives. So I think including the younger generation as well as those individuals that are later in their career, it can help foster excitement with the rest of the team, those that may be more aligned with the status quo. So, you know, it could be beneficial to include millennials and Gen Zs or whichever one we're on now, because they're actively a part of that forward momentum towards improvement and they can see. So taking both from our prior conversation and these additional thoughts, I think balance is key.
Absolutely. So Krista, of course, in a dream world, we would always have enough resources and staff and folks to be able to work on projects of this size. In your professional opinion, tell us, what do you think? Should these resources assigned to a project like this be full-time? Is it okay if they work on the project part-time? What about people, staff members rotating in and out of the project as things go along? Tell us your thoughts about that.
So I'm probably going to touch on some of the stuff that Jerry went into, but your core implementation team should include a full-time project manager and a system administrator and a couple of business or data analysts. These are the people who live and breathe the project every day. They track the project, handle communication, and make sure the work stays true to the contract and overall vision. So keeping consistency in these roles is critical because every time someone leaves, you lose momentum, institutional knowledge, and sometimes even trust within the team. So then you've got your part-time or rotating members. These I see as your subject matter experts, people from probation, facilities, reentry, classification, maybe even medical or community supervision. They come in during key phases like design, testing, and training. Having them rotate in and out ensures the real operational insight is part of every decision. But it also keeps them from being pulled too far from their daily responsibilities. Because one of the biggest challenges agencies face is staffing capacity. So for both the project team and the system users. So with people already having full workloads, dedicating large amount of their time to do this can feel impossible. So that kind of our theme, you know, that's where leadership support really matters. Having leaders to protect staff time and setting those realistic expectations for participation and make sure that no one is burning out. Trying to juggle all of this is important. And so, you know, having that continuity in leadership and project management level can make or break long-term success. So when key leaders or PMs change midstream, priorities shift, communication patterns reset, and you end up revisiting decisions that were already made, and so maintaining that consistency will shorten the amount of time when you're not having to revisit those decisions.
Yeah, right on, Krista. You know, all of us on projects like this, we always want the best and the brightest that the agency can provide, but it's hard for them to be able to do. It's hard for everybody to be able to give up all the work that they're doing each and every day for the agency to work on the project. So, Jerry, tell us your opinion on this particular question. I also would like to hear a little bit about what do you think about the right mix of the kinds of staff to have on this project between operational and technical?
So I do believe that there needs to be a core group that's full-time, and I think their day-to-day duties need to be reassigned to someone else. I think it's important for momentum. It's important to have that holistic top-level view of everything that's going on. I think when this doesn't happen, it's a struggle for them because they're trying to balance operational duties with project needs. We all know that operational concerns are priority, but not having the availability can have a really big impact on the timeline. It's both a risk and a critical success factor to your modernization effort. We talked about these individuals being your champions, those that help others at the local facility or office level, help them foster acceptance, help drive priorities for future enhancements and change requests after go live. Those, I think, require some type of full-time involvement, and whether that means reassigning them to the project team or IT indefinitely, I think even after go live, someone in that role is important. But beyond that core group, I agree with Krista here. I think that part-time participation and rotation also has a place, particularly those subject matter experts needed for specific areas like inmate trust or classification, sentencing good time, and so forth. They don't need to be assigned to the team throughout the project, but it is very important to include them in targeted activities, requirements, as is to be workflows, testing and validation, and such. Again, I think, you know, as we were talking about this before, the balance, I think you need the right mix of resources at the right time. So that's the ideal scenario, but this is corrections. And when do we ever have the ideal scenario, right? As you were saying, Rick. So what happens when this isn't your reality? What do you do when you aren't able to acquire those key resources, those that are knowledgeable as full-time members of your core group? Or you have assignments, but you're not able to redirect or backfill their operational duties. And we discussed the fact that these modernization efforts are sometimes years in the making based on scope, complexity, partial funding over multiple years, and how you may have decided to phase your effort, and that administrations change, having to regain that support. So what do you do in these in-between times when administration and personnel are shifting? One approach that we've used is to bring back those recently retired from their governmental posts who want to keep working. There's a wealth of knowledge there, and it's a fairly large pool, and you might even say a mass exodus of, you know, individuals in that age group that are retiring from state government that could be tapped into if you're not able to fill the need internally. And it doesn't have to necessarily be retirees from your own agency. Often positions such as warden and others are recruited from outside your own jurisdictions, so you could consider a similar approach to expand your candidate pool. We've also talked about staging or working in phases previously in the context of funding, but that same concept applies here. If you don't have all the right resources right now to do everything at once, then what decisions can you make to phase? What can you do with the resources you do have? Big bang versus phasing. And then in terms of the right mix between operational and technical, yeah, so far I've really just been talking about operational expertise. But of course, you have to have the right technical resources too. You have to have the business analysts to help define and document requirements, database administrators to help for data migration of the historical data, quality assurance analysts to test and make sure that the functionality that's being put in place is working, manage the bug identification and remediation and retesting once they've been fixed. Developers, you'll need to help create APIs to integrate with other systems. Report writers to create new reports and dashboards in your new OMS, and also help the operational areas understand data presentation and analysis. And while you may have some of this expertise in-house, you may not be able to cover all of your needs or be able to address the needs as you might require. So early on, understanding your personnel landscape and challenges in IT coverage is important. I would include a budget category for staff augmentation as you write your business case to obtain your funding so that you can make sure to cover your unmet need with forethought and writing into the correct way in the business case. Your staff augmentation contracts can cover both operational and technical needs. Another important consideration, and this ties into project management, is effective communication. And we've said it before, but I'll say it again, you need to campaign for the right resources and advocate why it's important for your modernization effort. And you need to make those that are leaders understand the potential impact both to the schedule and success if those business resources aren't actively involved. Leadership needs to understand that implementing an OMS isn't an IT project. The OMS or JMS is the backbone of any correctional agency. It's integrally tied to its mission. It impacts everyone and everything. And therefore, resource needs and participations need to be prioritized accordingly. And if it just isn't possible to get all the right resources now, then like I said a bit ago, what can you do with what you've got? And that's something we're all very used to in a correction environment of doing. But then based on those realities, you must also manage the expectation with leadership. Communicate openly and often on how that will impact the timeline and potentially compromise system acceptance.
Thank you, Lynn, Jerry, and Krista, for the incredible insights you shared with our listeners today. Well, folks, that brings us to the end of our conversation on implementing an OMS, the planning and staffing requirements. As we had heard, success really comes down to setting clear priorities, exercising strong leadership, and taking a thoughtful, people-centered approach to managing expectations of a project like this. Now, be sure to join us next time for episode number 5, where we're going to dive into organizational change management when implementing an offender management system. We're going to tackle big questions like, what are the most significant change management hurdles that agencies face today, and which tactical approaches or frameworks works best in a corrections environment? You won't want to miss it.
Thank you for tuning into today's episode of the Sounds of Safety podcast. Be sure to stay connected with the IGIS Institute on LinkedIn and X, and don't forget to subscribe on Apple Music, Spotify, or your preferred podcast platform to catch future episodes. From cybersecurity to artificial intelligence and deep dives into critical national data sharing initiatives, the Sounds of Safety podcast has you covered. Until next time.